Cops and Horrors is uncut tales from the front line. Matt Calverley offers an up-close and personal view into the life of a dedicated officer serving in one of the biggest police forces in the world. He's been involved in almost every aspect of the Metropolitan Police, including providing jury protection during huge corruption trials, qualifying as a mass fatality specialist, and also once getting bitten by a squirrel monkey called Clive. It is indeed a broad book. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK, author of Cops and Horrors, Matt Calverley. Matt, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. Just explain a little bit about when and why you decided to join. And it's the Met Police, isn't it? It's the Met.
It is the Metropolitan Police in London, yes. It was a childhood ambition to be a police officer. I'd always wanted to mainly have an adrenaline-fueled career, drive fast cars. So when I was initially tried at the age of 19 to join my local constabulary up in Lancashire, but I was too young, and then I saw an advert for the Met, so I sent the coupon off from the Sunday Times, and the rest is history.
And what was sort of the training like, and how exciting was it? I mean, was it all fast cars and Starsky and Hutch, which we obviously originally wanted to do?
No, it wasn't. No, that didn't kick in for about 5 or 6 years into my career. The training was basic training was quite tough and grueling, having to run a couple of miles through Wanstead Flats twice a week, carrying a 60-kilogram log. A lot of the law and procedure training, which is like going back to school, self-defense training, where I got my lip split open by one of my own teeth. The actual reason for joining, sort of driving fast cars, etc., didn't actually get to until about 5 or 6 years in, when I was fairly well experienced with the frontline stuff.
And what's it like? Because obviously the Metropolitan Police, and presumably is it the largest force in the UK, and obviously a huge catchment area, if you like. I mean, a huge variety of cultures and communities to be dealing with.
Yes, it's the largest force in the UK. It has round about 30,000 officers, and it polices the whole of London apart from the city, which is about 9 million people, I think about 12% of the population of the UK or thereabouts. And yes, so every diversity and culture that you could possibly want.
So what was your progression then, if you like? I mean, everybody presumably starts off as, you know, and here comes the cliche, as the Bobby on the beat. And did you spend a couple of years sort of pounding the pavements, or how was your progression through the Met?
Yes, just that, basically. I spent 2 or 3 years on the beat. Then I started doing driver training, did my standard, basic and standard driver training, and then eventually managed to get selected for the advanced driver training, which would allow me to drive the fast cars and chase bad guys. The training wasn't quite straightforward. Just before I was due to go on my advanced driving course, I got wiped out by a salmonella infection from a dodgy burger, which I have mentioned in the book.
Right. So was that actually on the beat? Was that sort of, if you like, a police injury, the dodgy burger?
Absolutely, it was. Yes, it was a late shift. I made a packed lunch, but forgot to take it to work with me, so I had to resort to getting a burger and chips takeaway. And I'm 6'3" tall. I ended up going down to below 7 stone in weight. Spent 2 weeks in hospital. Bad business, but eventually recovered.
That's not a bad burger. That's a biohazard, Matt.
Yes. Yeah, I was being in Northwick Park Hospital for a couple of weeks in a sealed glass box with communication via telephone, and all the medics wearing full PPE because I didn't know what I had at that point. It was a bit like something from a sci-fi film, yes.
Blimey, O'Reilly. So you got into the driving then. Just give us a sort of a flavour, if you like. We imagine that sort of far advanced driving for police, we always imagine, you know, the Sweeney chasing through. But it's not that, isn't it? It can also be, because I've got friends who have been outriders, for example, when you're taking perhaps high-security prisoners from a court, Paddington Green, to a prison, or taking them up north or something like that. So explain a little bit about what that entails.
Well, there's a lot of strands to advanced driving. I mean, the priority of it is to be able to get to emergency calls quickly. And then secondary to that is to be able to conduct vehicle pursuits safely. There are other strands, as you described, are escorts of high security prisoners, high value loads, abnormal loads as well. There are some sort of 100 ton cranes that need to get in and out of central London. They need police outriders. It's all to do with the overriding concern is public safety and making sure that what you do is done as safely as possible while trying to, for example, get to an emergency within 12 minutes, which can be very difficult in central London.
To put it mildly, the book also looks at your run-ins with the criminal fraternity, obviously, because you're a policeman. And there's been, ever since sort of the late 90s and that whole Mockney thing, there's been that sort of romanticising of the criminal fraternity. We are always getting books about the craze and are they only looked after their own, they only hurt their own, etc., etc. The reality about dealing with hardened criminals is they're not very cuddly, are they?
Not at all, no. It's a bit of a cliche, but a law unto themselves. Most times you interact with a criminal and arrest them, it happens with the minimum of fuss. It's not like you see on the TV. Most criminals know the score. They know what's going to happen. They know if they kick off, it'll only get worse for them. There are exceptions, obviously, as I've mentioned in the books, times when I had some pretty difficult arrests and came away with quite a few bumps and scrapes and bruises. But overall, it's very glamorized on TV, and it's not the reality. The reality is almost mundane.
Mm. Tell me a bit about, because I can't let you go say, well, you know, the bumps and scratches. I mean, presumably there are those who have been perhaps a little reticent to come with you when you gently put your hand on their collar.
Yes, indeed. There's one incident I've written about in the book, which was an off-duty arrest where I was on my way home from a night shift, almost. Well, looking forward to getting to bed, basically. The Sunday morning, 6 a.m, the roads are quite quiet. An accident happened right in front of me on the A40, which was, as it turns out, was deliberate. It was one vehicle deliberately rammed another one and then sped off while the driver was wearing a balaclava. So I took off after this tow truck. I got my phone to Scotland Yard, phone 999, and told them I'm off duty in my own car. I need some help to catch this guy who's just deliberately caused an accident. Eventually, this tow truck, as it was I was chasing, crashed into a fence. The driver jumped out and ran off. I jumped out and ran after him, caught up with him in the middle of a council estate in a kids' play area, and we had a right old bundle. He was bigger than me, quite muscular. He managed to land a few good punches. And then probably one of the scariest moments of my entire career, as I looked across in the dawn, across the grass, and saw two more people sprinting towards me. And I thought that this guy had managed to get a call into his mates, and this was going to be, I was going to lose the one-on-one, and this was going to be three-on-one. Fortunately, this was a couple, a nice young couple who'd also seen the crash on the A40 and had basically come to my rescue. The guy had no hesitation mucking in and helping me restrain this guy who was on the ground while his girlfriend got on the phone, told Scotland Yard exactly where we were. And help soon arrived. And there was a priceless moment at the end when the help had arrived and we'd handcuffed this guy. I was a bit bruised and battered and bleeding. We pulled this guy to his feet and he looked at the woman who, by this point, had burst into tears because of the emotion of it all, and swore at her lots and let her know that he would recognise her face if he ever saw her again, at which point her demeanour changed completely and she kicked him in the balls so hard that she lifted him off the ground. And then we ended up, the three of us, me and the young couple, getting a nice commendation. So it was, but that was quite a scary moment. And I certainly got home a lot later than I was expected, with a lot of cuts and bruises.
Yeah, I mean, we come on to the sort of the more comedic or the lighter moments, but there have been, I mean, the nature of the business, it is horrendous at times. I mean, we have tales of a crash scene, what looks like an ordinary crash scene, and then you find photographs, presumably in the car or something, that lead to a child rapist being jailed.
Yes, that was an elderly guy who managed to overturn his car. I went to hospital with him. We thought he was quite badly injured, but it turns out he wasn't. And while part of my role was to identify him, search his belongings, search his wallet, and I found a hidden compartment in his wallet. It had been cut open with a knife and super glued shut. I prized it open and out dropped a handful of Polaroid photographs of this guy raping a child no older than 9, 10 years old, including photographs where he'd caught his own face in a mirror. So this went to the, eventually went, managed to identify the child. This matter went to the Old Bailey for a trial. He pleaded not guilty, so the child had to give evidence, which was very traumatic, but he was found guilty, and he was jailed for a total of 34 years, I think, for various offences. But he died in prison 3 years later, which was, I think, a little bit of closure for the victim and her parents.
Hmm. When you get something like that, you know, you must, especially come, if you're sitting out to get somebody who you know has done, you know, you suspect of doing something like that, then that's fair. But to come across this accidentally, I mean, that must shake you up quite a bit.
Absolutely. I was totally not expecting it. And at the time, my own daughter was 4 years old, so I was quite a protective father figure. So to be dealing with what appeared to be a relatively minor road traffic accident, it looked spectacular, the car had overturned, but injury-wise, it was minor. And then to have that dealing with one of the most horrendous crimes I'd ever dealt with, completely out of the blue, yes, it proper shook me up, yes.
You talk about the woman before saying, the guy saying, I will recognise you. You've dealt with jury protection as well, haven't you?
Yes, that was in the mid-90s. It was a large corruption trial. Several defendants had known to have strong underworld connections, so the judge ordered that the jury of 12 men and women would be guarded around the clock for 6 weeks as the trial took. So that involved 72 police officers, six for each juror, working in three pairs, guarding them literally around the clock, parking outside the house overnight, following them when they went shopping, and then taking them to court 5 days a week.
That sounds, I mean, again, we think of that in the movies. We're thinking of, you know, guys outside the door and the whole situation. Does Hollywood stroke the UK film industry get it right at all, or is it all pretty much invention?
It's pretty much invention. If Hollywood and certain police space soaps were true to life, they would be so boring, nobody would watch them, because the amount of action and adrenaline that they portray is a far higher ratio than the actual real life.
And also, you qualified as a mass fatality specialist. What exactly is? I mean, obviously, it's dealing with the deceased. But just explain a little bit about what that is and why you train for that.
Well, that came about for me after the 7/7 bombings in London, where 52 innocent people were killed. I was a patrol sergeant at the time, so my role was limited to supervising security cordons and the temporary mortuary, and basically supervising constables on security duty, and it was very, very boring. And I thought, I want to get more involved in this sort of thing, tragic though they are. So after 7/7, the Met realised they didn't have enough mass fatality specialists, so they advertised for more, so I was accepted. And we trained for several weeks to basically attend the scene of mass fatalities, to recover bodies, body parts, to take them to mortuaries to carry out post-mortems with a pathologist and a photographer, preserving the integrity, preserving the dignity, obtaining evidence against the terrorists or whatever the cause was. And from the scene to handing the body back to the family for the funeral, it was that seamless, taking it through every stage.
That's presumably, I mean, you've had various skill sets throughout your career, which has been varied, as you said, everything from, you know, chasing criminals and fighting and, you know, one-on-ones and in kids' car parks and whatever. But that dealing with dignity, which is the word you used, mm-hmm. is presumably, you know, is something that you have to use, and I'm not going to come all woke on you, don't worry, but in terms of integrity and decency are words that are cornerstones of what we should be doing in the modern police force.
Yes, absolutely. Integrity and decency should underscore everything that we do. The Met is not in a good place at the moment. Obviously, there's been a lot of bad publicity about some people who should never, ever be allowed near a police uniform, particularly, for example, the Wayne Cousins case was the most notorious one. And it's sometimes it becomes a bit of a forgotten priority integrity and decency, particularly when you're dealing with a family of mass fatality victims. We have a duty to recover evidence, to persecute the offenders. At the same time, you've got a family here who want closure, they want their loved one back, they want to have a funeral, and it's balancing those two things with the decency, with the integrity, is the challenge.
The book isn't all sort of, you know, arrests and as we talked about earlier, there's some lightheartedness in it as well. It came. The first thing that struck me in the press notes I was handed was being bitten by a squirrel monkey called Clive. Now, is the threat of primates, small primates, a particular one that the Met faces on a daily basis?
I would have to say no. I think this was a unique moment. This was a Sunday morning, very early in my career, and Scotland Yard sent us to a report of an escaped monkey climbing into a lady's house.
Right.
We rejected the call several times because Sunday mornings are prime time for practical jokes. But Scotland Yard insisted, so we went down, and there in this house in Shepherd's Bush, this nice suburban house, was a fluorescent green and yellow squirrel monkey in a kitchen, about the size of a domestic cat with a long tail, sat on a worktop eating a hard-boiled egg that this bemused housewife had given it.
Right.
So I asked her, is it tame? She said, yes, it's clearly domesticated. It's been, you know, playing with the kids and all sorts. So my colleague went outside to make phone calls to London Zoo, RSPCA, anybody else he could think of. Well, I approached this monkey and offered it my hand, and it was tame, it was domesticated. It played with my fingers, and it ran at my arm, sat on my shoulder like a pirate's parrot.
Right.
And then my mistake was when the lady's husband produced a large cardboard box to put it in while we waited to find what to do with it. So I went to take it off my shoulder, and it sank its teeth straight through my left thumb and almost took the thumb off at the knuckle. So I ripped it away from my hand and looked down. My thumb was partially detached, blood everywhere. And then the kitchen floor raced up to meet me. Everything went black. And I woke up sprawled across the back seat of a police car with a siren screaming as my colleague was shouting, "Hang on, we're nearly there." And we raced up to hospital and I had my thumb sewn back together. And it took me about a year to get full use of it back, but I did get full use of it back. Meanwhile, the monkey climbed back through the window and went home.
What level of banter did you get from your colleagues about the squirrel monkey incident then?
Absolutely merciless, yes.
Sorry, Matt, I shouldn't laugh, but I'm just thinking because it's a high-pressure situation you deal with, and there has to be that humour, doesn't there? Because you're dealing, you know...
I wouldn't have it any other way. Yeah, it's absolutely. And when anybody has any embarrassing incident, even ones that involve injury like this, the banter is absolutely merciless. And that's, to me, that's the way it should be.
And also you had brushes with celebrities. Paul Daniels, that well-known magician, who you think would be able to go, "That's magic," and get into his own car, proves that he didn't actually have the magic when it came to unlocking his own door.
Yes, that was at the BBC car park in Shepherd's Bush. He managed to lock his keys in his car, so I turned up to help him out, not knowing who he was at the time. And when I accepted the call, and I turned up, and I thought, this has got to be a joke. You can't get into a locked car. And he's like, "No, I really can't." So I had some gadgets with me, a bit of tinkering, and got his keys out in about 10 minutes. And he was very grateful, very lovely gentleman. And he said, "That's great. How did you do that?" So I couldn't resist and just said, "That's magic."
Oh, brilliant.
That was handed to me on a plate, that punchline, I'm afraid.
Indeed. And this is a brilliant one. You presumably you need to get a lift to a situation. You stop a car, you leap in, and then, well, it must have been an interesting one for you. Explain to the listeners, Matt, what happened with the limo.
Yeah, well, as a bobby on the beat, I used to get frustrated that I could hear emergency calls on the radio and I was too far away. I was on foot. I couldn't get to them. So I started just flagging down private cars and saying, "Can you give me a lift?" And most people that really appealed to their public-spirited nature, they would help me out. One car I flagged down on a Saturday night was a stretch limo, and the driver's like, "Yes, no problem." It was I need to get to a road accident about a mile away. That was all it was. The driver's like, "No problem, plenty of room in the back." So I opened the back door, and there was a hen party in the back with... about half a dozen very drunk, very scantily dressed 20-something young ladies. I hesitated because I thought, I'll flag another car down. But the bride-to-be was having none of it, and she literally grabbed my lapels and pulled me into the cabin, into the limo, and shut the door. So in the sort of 3-4 minutes it took to drive to the scene of this accident, there was the usual banter of show us your truncheon and all the usual stuff. And then we arrived at the scene of this crash, and before I could get out of the limo, some of the hens had to get out to let me out. So all these drunk, scantily clad women tumbled out, followed by a policeman, and I tried to sort of straighten up my clothes, my uniform, my helmet, and march up to the scene of this crash and speak to these two drivers who were just looking utterly bewildered. And I had to show them, look, I am a real police officer. I'm not a stripper from that party. And they took some convincing. From then on, I was a bit more selective about who I flagged down.
Yeah, but what a way to arrive. And again, the banter must have been off the scale with that one.
Oh, absolutely, yes. And it's only arriving in style.
So the book, why did you decide to put this all down in the book Cops and Horrors? Because it has been a fascinating career thus far.
Well, yeah, that came about 3 years after I retired. We were, my wife and I were returning from a holiday, and just over the Atlantic on the way back from Cuba. And I'd been in the habit for a long time of telling police-related stories to my kids and to my wife and other people, anybody who'd listen, basically. And when I told a story to my wife on the plane, and she sort of said, oh, just write it down, will you? So I thought, okay, I'll write it down. I started writing it down, and I started writing more stories down, and then I ended up with over 300 individual stories from my policing career. And then I sent a Freedom of Information request to the Met for my service records, which they sent to me, which gave me all my list of all my commendations, injuries on duty, all my training courses, which gave me a date framework, and put it all together from there. And then got myself an agent, a ghostwriter, Nicholas Stowe, who's an award-nominated ghostwriter. And then we published just over a month ago.
The book is called Cops and Horrors, Secret Tales from the Frontline. It's by Matt Calverley, who is speaking to you today. Matt, if people want to find out more information about the book or about you, is there social media? Do you have a website? Where can people find you and find out more tales about the life?
Well, I'm on Facebook and Twitter. They can find me there. And on the Mirror Books website, which is the publisher, there's more information on there. It's available from Mirror Books and Amazon. It's also available from 15 countries worldwide, including many in Europe. So it's widely available if you Google Cops and Horrors, Matt Calvert.
And it will also be available as a virtual download from our own virtual bookstore. The book is called Cops and Horrors, Secret Tales from the Frontline. It's by Matt Calvert, who's speaking to you today. Matt, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.